Welcome to Season 1, Episode 1 of the Oregon Reporter Podcast, your monthly review of the most important and interesting law updates in Oregon, including recent appellate decisions, legislation, and how those things might affect practicing attorneys in the state. I'm Everett Meadows, a litigation attorney at Gardner Beckley Meadows in Eugene, Oregon.
And I'm Tom Mosman, a business attorney and sole practitioner at Mosman General Counsel, also in Eugene, Oregon.
This episode of the Oregon Reporter Podcast qualifies you for one general CLE credit, which you can report on your MCLE transcript at osbar.org. You can find reporting instructions in the show notes or at oregonreporterpodcast.com. Today's MCLE event ID is 111146, which has been submitted to the MCLE department, but at the time of this recording is still pending approval. All case citations and additional materials are in the show notes for you to follow along at home. Today's episode of the Oregon Reporter Podcast is brought to you by CC Reporting, providing remote court reporting services across the state of Oregon and in-person coverage from Salem to Medford. Schedule online at ccreporting.com. CC Reporting, we've got you covered. And Gardner Beckley Meadows, representing individuals and business owners throughout the state in the areas of real property, domestic relations, business matters, trusts and estates, and more. GardnerBeckley.com.
So today we'll be covering three items. The first is the FTC's newly passed rule essentially banning non-competes. Second is the Grants Pass homeless case being heard by the U.S. Supreme Court this month. And third, House Bill 4121 affecting the cannabis and hemp industries here in Oregon. So let's get started. Our first matter, as mentioned, is going to be the FTC ban on non-competes. By way of just a little bit of background, non-competes are agreements between parties that prohibit parties or a party from engaging in competing activities, as the name would suggest. They are usually a creature of state statute or common law, and some states, like California, have already made a great effort to ban non-competes entirely.
Yeah, but really, really tough to do non-competes in California.
Right. Other states like Oregon just have a few rules and parameters around those, timing as far as like when you're supposed to give them, essentially giving the party that's signing the non-compete a heads up, plenty of time to review it. There's only certain roles and positions that can sign them, and there are compensation thresholds. So you got to be above a certain amount of salary to be given one of these.
With that said, Oregon has historically had a pretty sort of laissez-faire attitude about these things relatively, right?
That's right. And so it's a big deal because there's a difference between the states and among the states as to how these non-competes are set up and if they're enforceable. But now the FTC comes in and they say, hey, we want to make them completely unenforceable across the country. A big development there.
So, you know, Tom, in your, obviously there's more to this than this, but I just sort of as a starting place, in your business, have you gotten a lot of calls or inquiries about this?
Yeah, I would say most of the employers I've worked with throughout the course of my time practicing have had some notion of wanting to have a non-compete in place. I've been a part of matters where folks have departed and they've worked for competing companies and created quite an issue. So there's always been a question against non-competes, sort of as a matter of public policy. The idea being that we don't want to restrict how someone works and how they, you know, earn their income, how they take care of their family. So there is a bit of a balance there. But yeah, I've encountered a lot of them over my time. And one of the things that often folks are encouraged to do, what business attorneys encourage their clients to do, is some version of a non-compete, kind of a pivot out of the traditional non-compete into a non-solicit of customers, clients, things like that. And we'll talk about that a little bit more in a minute. Yeah, how about you? Have you experienced those?
You know, we do run into it a bit. I would say most of the time in my practice, I'm actually running into people who are, you know, going into a new business or transitioning and saying, what can I do?
Sure.
I've not been involved on the front end of that all that often. I know when I moved firms this last time to come over to Gardner Beckley Meadows, it was one of the things I had to look at. There were some restrictions on what I could do, not in terms of practicing law, but in terms of, you know, employees I may later hire or whatever, you know. And yeah, so it was a thing. Oh, it was like the first time in my life, like, oh, I got to think about this.
Well, and it is. I mean, it makes sense from the employer's side. You've trained up this employee. You've brought them on board. You've got them, you know, their skills have been increased. You've increased their, you know, marketability in the industry, whatever industry you're in. And there's some protection that the employers want, that that person can't go hop over to another company, take all the stuff that they learned, all the skills that they developed with you. So it, you know, it makes sense from both sides. So the question is, can we have this federal ban now? Can the FTC actually say no non-competes?
So what does the FTC's new rule actually do?
Right. So it applies to most workers, paid or not. So volunteers and paid employees. The idea is there can be no new non-compete agreements. And for existing non-compete agreements, they only are effective for certain high-wage earners. I think so, they call them senior executives.
So this actually goes into effect as to existing contracts.
Right.
You know, it's so rare that the law will do that, that a legislature will do that. Oftentimes things are grandfathered.
It's pretty amazing, actually, yeah. And in fact, and we can talk about it more in a minute, but there's a notice requirement. Employers are now required through the FTC's rules. I shouldn't say now, actually. That's another bone of contention as to when and if this will actually roll out. But assuming it does come to fruition at some point, they have to send out a notice. The FTC has a prescribed like narrative, a little letter you're supposed to send out. You can do it by mail, email, text even. So yeah, it's an interesting retroactive, basically voiding of these contracts, except for a very limited number of high wage earners.
Like, hey, we told you couldn't go work somewhere else, but now we have to tell you, you're free to take all of our business and trade secrets to your next company.
Well, and you point out something actually extremely important. And I mentioned this a minute ago. There is this notion of a general non-compete. You cannot go work for one of our competitors. You cannot start up a new business that's going to compete with us. But, you know, I think most savvy business attorneys understand that there's other ways to avoid even calling that into question, to not even get to the question of do we have a non-compete, and that is with a confidentiality agreement, an NDA, a non-disclosure agreement, or even, as I mentioned before, a non-solicitation of clients. So there are ways you can protect that IP. So you do train that person up. They're there for 2 or 3 years. They've got all your customer lists. They've got all of your intellectual property on the inside. They know your trade secrets. Those are still protectable through NDAs, confidentiality agreements, and even non-solicitation of your customers list.
Yeah, I was going to ask that. So I think that the most common sort of, like you said, the non-solicitation agreement, which really says you're not allowed to take our employees often, or you're not allowed to solicit our employees, and you're not allowed to solicit our customers.
That's right.
And I've actually litigated this issue with regards to customers in the past. And it's a lot of times a question mark. Like, what was the solicitation? Did they, you know, they came to you, were you required to push them away? And I'll usually know is the answer.
Yeah.
But like, who contacted who?
Yeah.
Where was that contact? You know, you text messaged them to go out to drinks. What did you talk about at that dinner?
right?
Did you talk about them coming over? Because then the next day they said,
that's funny, we're looking for a software engineer. How interesting that we're getting these beverages together.
Yeah, that's right.
So, but again, that goes to the question of wanting to protect the company's IP. And so you can't just take the customer list. It's going to get into a he said, she said, and definitely a fact-finding mission if you get to a point where you're litigating this because, lo and behold, a customer did go to this competing company that your former employee went to. So it does get a little tricky, a little dicey. And frankly, you know, I mentioned a second ago, we don't still know how this is going to roll out. The timeline is the FTC rolled this out on the 23rd of April, 24. Yeah. The very next day, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce was ready to go. They were ready to file. So April 24th, I believe in Texas, they filed a motion. They were looking to either get an injunction against it or to put a stay on when it would become effective. A couple other parties joined the U.S. Chamber and in response, the FTC said, sure, you know, we'll address these. They asked for an extension of time. So the timeline looks like around the 15th of May of 24, the FTC's opposition is going to be due. And the chamber will have a chance to reply on May 28th. So this is kind of a wait and see mode. No one's really sure yet exactly what's going to come of this. And at the same time, go ahead.
According to the normal timelines, this would get published in the Register nowish, and in fact, it may already be. I don't know. I didn't check the Register this morning, but this could be as soon as it gets reported in the Federal Register, it's 120 days, which would put us, what, late August?
That's right.
For which is still right now the effective timeline.
That's right.
Yeah,
that's right. And I think the important thing to keep in mind is while a wait and see approach makes sense for, you know, if you're an employer, you've got some program in place for non-competes, or even non-solicitations, this is a good time to review those contracts, to review what you have in place, so that you can prepare yourself, you know, if and when this does actually become rolled out and the law that we all have to comply with, you will already have sort of a stock of what you have in your company, in your employee files. So
you mentioned that the U.S. Chamber of Commerce was ready to go, and obviously they were.
Yeah,
you know, there's a really pretty complex, legally complex brief that they filed the next day.
That's right.
After the rule was announced, but it bears mentioning this has been something that has been in the concept or in the ideas of the people who are interested in this for almost a year, a little over a year.
That's right. I think it was January of 23. They did their initial rule proposal and they took comments. I think there was something like 25,000 comments that they got from across the country, both pro and against.
I've got a statistic here that says over 26,000 comments, with 25,000 of them being in favor of the ban.
Right.
Which makes sense, right?
There's more employees than there are companies.
That's right. The vast majority of these people are employees.
That's right.
But employers are not happy. What is the U.S. Chamber of Commerce what's the crux of their argument?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think, you know, they're saying that it's going to stifle business, essentially. Like, we can't operate in a system where we can't protect our IP and the inside, you know, information that we have by letting employees walk. I also, you know, I'm not sure. There was a couple other parties that signed on to that Texas filing, and I'm not sure exactly. I haven't read through all of their statements, but you know, they see it as a threat to businesses.
You know, the other question that popped into my mind was, does the FTC have the authority to actually regulate this type
of conduct?
That's
a really good point you make, and that's among the questions. Yeah, does this overstep the FTC's authority to implement something like this? And I think that's one of the things the Chamber of Commerce is pushing on too.
The FTC, for their part, obviously says, you know, of course we do.
Right. We're obviously, a government agency. We can do what we want.
I think, in fact, their earlier comments are like, our authority to do this is crystal clear, which does not mean that it is, in fact, crystal clear.
That's
so
right.
I think this is an interesting one. It will be interesting to see the FTC's response and then the replies. I assume we'll get U.S. Chamber of Commerce replies shortly thereafter. So, of course, we don't know what the parties are going to say, but we can certainly speculate.
Yeah.
Do you have any predictions about how this is going to go?
That's a good question, Everett. Thank you. I don't. I mean, I think the strength of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce is formidable. I think that there could be some, I think the questions asked the FTC authority are going to be heavily discussed. So can they actually roll this out?
Yeah, you know, we don't have a Supreme Court right now that is, I think, particularly inclined to harm businesses, right?
Yeah, right.
So this is, you know, with a primarily Republican-appointed Supreme Court or a majority Republican.
Business-friendly, yeah.
You know, I think that there's going to be a pretty strong degree of skepticism here, both with regards to the FTC's authority, big government authority, and with regards to whether or not this type of prohibition on contracting is legal in and of itself.
Well, and then, you know, in your opinion, and having litigated these things, what, you know, my opinion is that between non-disclosure agreements, confidentiality agreements, and non-solicitation agreements, you can get most of the way there. And so there's a piece of me that thinks, look, I understand the blanket non-compete makes sense. It's useful. It's convenient. It's efficient. But at the same time, what you're really going after, and a lot of attorneys do this anyway, if a client says, I need a non-compete, they say, well, look, we don't know how strongly that's going to hold up in whatever jurisdiction you're in, but we do know that we have other tools we can use. So,
yeah, and it's important to note that this doesn't affect the vast majority of folks in the United States, even though its applicability is arguably encompassing.
Right.
It, there are already significant restrictions on this. Even in Oregon, you know, California, we talked about, has these huge restrictions, but Oregon, I mean, there are compensation restrictions, there are types of position restrictions. You know, this doesn't apply to a 17-year-old kid that gets a job at Cold Stone and is now restricted from working at Baskin Robbins. That you already can't limit that. That's not something. So really what we're talking about is higher compensated people, white collar positions generally.
That's right.
This is not something that is going to affect every single employee in a meaningful way.
That's right. Yeah, I think that's important.
Yeah. Anything else you want to add about this? I think before we move on.
Not particularly. I think one thing, and I didn't quite finish my comment to you, Everett, though, from my perspective, when you're putting this together on the front end, as I mentioned, you can protect the vast majority of the IP this is intended to. On the back end, what I wonder is, you know, have you had experience on suits over non-solicitations, over NDAs?
Yeah, sorry. And it's a good question. So I have litigated the issue of non-solicitation agreements, particularly with regard to client non-solicitation. So what the law is pretty clear about is that a non-solicitation agreement is enforceable. And there are other general principles that apply to those things. You know, trade secrets are, you oftentimes don't even need to have a contract to protect. Like, you're not allowed, you know, this is trade secrets. That can be on your handbook even. Yeah, right. It's not something that they have to sign. It's just, this is the rule. You can't take our trade secrets. There always becomes a question in those litigations, what's a trade secret? So is a client list a trade secret? And I would argue that oftentimes it can be if the identity of your clients is not public.
That's right.
It sure can be. And so, like you said, there are ways for businesses to protect these things outside of the context of non-competes. And in fact, a non-compete, except in pretty narrow circumstances, it is like pretty minimally powerful.
That's right.
Because, you know, how often are you actually worried about them doing the same thing? Most of the time you're worried about them taking your clients, you know.
And there are those limits that you mentioned too. And then there's geographically limited, time limited. You know, I think in Oregon it's like 12 months now. So, you know, again, there's tools there, there's protections there that you can have in place to protect you. And the last thing I wanted to mention on the FTC rule that's been put forth too, something to keep in mind is this is in the employee-employer context. So if you have agreements between businesses, those still stand, right? You can, the companies can agree between themselves. The franchise or franchisee paradigm, that still stands as far as non-competes go. So this is really limited to employees and their employers. So
yeah. And also it's unclear, having reviewed the rules, it was unclear to me that this would necessarily apply to like a franchisor, franchisee, or even to an executive, right? I think it's possible that to the extent an executive or like a member of an LLC or a shareholder,
that's right.
To the extent they're not an employee,
that's right.
I think this could theoretically be enforceable.
That's right.
A non-compete.
That's right. Board of directors, LLC members. That's right. It's really focused at the employee relationships. If you're a passive owner or something, it's like, well, we can make sure that you don't leave and take those, go leave and compete against us.
Yeah, that's right. So, so again, this is our first episode, and so we've not done any of this before. We're going to say a few things during this episode that are like, hey, just generally speaking, if you want to know how this works, here's what you do. For all of these things, for this topic, the FTC topic, and the topics we're about to talk about, there will be links in the show notes to this episode. So wherever you're listening to this thing, on Spotify or on Apple Podcasts, it doesn't matter. You should have access to a set of show notes, which will have links, hyperlinks, to the information that we're sharing with you and where we've gleaned our information. So for this, the rule and the FTC's guide, the actual text of the rule and the guide will be in the show notes, as well as a few blog posts that I think we read in order to prepare for this. So that'll all be in the show notes, and you can go down there and link it and use them as your materials as you do or don't like.
And additionally for this one, you know, make sure, get your calendar out and make sure you circle May 28th.
Yeah.
For when the Shaper's going to have to do the reply brief. Then we'll have all the information in front of us. So.
Yeah, that's right. Next up, we're going to talk about a Supreme Court case, a United States Supreme Court case that was heard on oral arguments the week that we're recording this, probably about 2 weeks ago when you're hearing this for the first time, but having to do with an Oregon city. So
yeah, pretty cool.
Grants Pass v. Johnson et al. Is a case that is about the right to sleep as a homeless person on city property. And this stems from a class action lawsuit brought by a group of Oregon unhoused people that were in Grants Pass and who were facing Grants Pass new-ish at the time, prohibition on sleeping in public. Mm-hmm. They were certified by a class in the district court as a group of similarly unhoused homeless people. And the lawsuit came about because Grants Pass has no shelters, or at the time had no shelters. It essentially came about as a result of this class arguing, we're being punished for our mere existence. We, you know, sleeping is a basic human need, which is true. And so this rule actually punishes our existence more so than the conduct of sleeping.
Right.
District court following precedent, issued an injunction. And then this went to the Court of Appeals, and the Court of Appeals, withheld the injunction based on the Eighth Amendment against cruel and unusual punishment. The Eighth Amendment to the United States Constitution prohibiting cruel and unusual punishment, saying that it was a violation of the Eighth Amendment when there was no, and this is a quote, when there was no other place in the city for homeless persons to go.
Right.
So essentially the Court of Appeals said, yeah, you can't do this. This is a basic human need and there's no other way for them to get the sleep that they need. And so this is cruel and unusual punishment. This was then raised to the Supreme Court, unsurprisingly, where it was heard for oral arguments this week.
Yeah, 23rd?
Yeah, right? the 23rd it was heard, or the 24th, one of the two. So that would be April 23rd, this was heard at the Supreme Court. The great thing about doing this is in 2024, doing what we're doing today in 2024, is we have so much access. Right. We were able to, the very next day, download the entire transcript of those oral arguments.
Which were fascinating and fun.
Which is just totally terrific.
Yeah, right.
Like, you know, in the 80s or 90s or hell, the 2010s, oftentimes, you'd have to like wait for somebody to write about their interpretation of what happened. You can just go read
the next day
the transcript of the oral arguments.
Which is pretty fun. And I suggest everyone looks at the show notes and goes and reads this.
So, really, the argument is, the Eighth Amendment is unique in that because of the way it's framed, it's a substantive and not a procedural protection, constitutional, which is rare. Most constitutional protections are procedural. You can do this procedure except in these circumstances. This is substantive. You shall not do these things to people. Which makes it a little bit of an outlier, and it makes Eighth Amendment analyses a little different. If you're really used to traditional sort of Fourth Amendment or 14th Amendment analysis, it can be a little bit off-putting to read these Eighth Amendment cases because it doesn't track quite the same way. There are two kind of important cases at this point that bear mentioning in this conversation. And I'll mention them briefly, and we'll have show notes to these down below in the show notes, or we'll have links to these in the show notes. The first is Trop v. Dulles. It's a 1958 case where the Supreme Court struck down a law which removed a man's United States citizenship for having deserted in World War II. Mm-hmm. It's actually a fascinating case, and the decision is written by Chief Justice Earl Warren, and it's a kind of a, you know, like almost all of the decisions he wrote, it's this really beautiful,
massive,
prosy But essentially, he argues or he writes that rules have these kind of rules need to be pragmatic and they need to keep up with the times.
Right.
It's crazy because it's such a different from a relatively conservative justice. It's such a different approach.
Do you have the quote there? You got to read it.
Yeah. So the rule, the amendment must draw its meaning from the evolving standards of decency. Oof. That mark the progress of a maturing society.
So what's our court going to do with that?
you know, we're in a much different place with regards to the composure, the makeup of the court. And so I don't see this quote being repeated in the current decision. We'll see.
Evolving obviously. Standards of decency. That's the key terminology in there that I think if the prior decisions are considered by the court, I don't know that one's going to motivate them to fine for the class here. I don't know.
Yeah, right. It's a tough, I mean, it really is a tough call at this point, because certainly you can see where the court might come at this, but there are some inherent sort of problems, pragmatic problems with what they're doing. The other case that is important, and this is perhaps the more famous of the two cases, but Robinson v. Mm-hmm. California, 1962 case, where the court struck down a California law criminalizing addiction to narcotics.
Right.
And really, this is the case that people point to say you can't punish. You can't punish status.
A status, yeah. Who the person is, not what they're doing.
Being right. Addicted to drugs is a status.
Yeah.
And the argument, of course, the class argument here is that homelessness is a status.
Right.
It's not the act of sleeping in the park that's actually a problem. Right. It's the act of being homeless which causes you to have to sleep in the park.
Well, and there are questions from the justices in the transcript where they're asking, so they looked at testimony from the police officers and they said, you know, why were you enforcing this? How are you enforcing this? And there was questions about, you know, are you going to, I believe it was Justice Sotomayor was asking, so would you punish a baby, you know, taking a nap? Would you punish a stargazer who fell asleep?
Right.
So are you saying, I don't have it right in front of me, unfortunately, at the moment, but I believe the comment was, you know, this police officer says, well, they have another home to go to, so therefore they can be in the park taking this nap. And so that, you could see the justices kind of struggling with that distinction.
Yeah, well, and it's a really fair point, too, because you're not going to punish a couple of, you know, high school lovers who have fallen asleep.
Right.
Who have fallen asleep in the park holding each other's hands, they're not going to be punished. Or perhaps an otherwise sort of middle-class family that's camping in a place that they maybe shouldn't be camping.
Sure.
You know, those folks likely aren't going to be punished under this
sure.
rule. And so that becomes a question of, not only pragmatism, but also intent, which gets back to the Robinson v. California decision.
Right, and not punishing status, yeah.
You know, I think it's important to note for the sake of this that homelessness is increasing every year. The percent of the population that is unhoused mm-hmm. is huge. In 2023, I think it was something like 653. I think I have the figure here, but something like 543,000 people, which is up 12% from even 2022.
Right.
So we are, notwithstanding the figures we're getting from the government and the Fed about the state of the economy, which those numbers are compelling. And certainly, you know, we've still got a percentage of the population that is suffering in sort of unprecedented ways. And so how do these cities address these things? There's the interest of the city in preparing safe feeling and comfortable spaces. And there's also, drug associations with concentrations of homelessness people. You know, in Eugene, we famously evicted hundreds of people from the Washington Jefferson Park a few years back. You know, how do cities address these things?
Well, I think there was this Harvard Law Review, and I liked the way they framed it. They said, you know, are camping bans a legitimate way to tackle the nationwide homeless crisis? Or are we criminalizing, you know, an unavoidable human need? You know, some sympathy, some human interest here. And so, you know, it does beg the question, is this the route we're going to take to address a nationwide challenge, especially as we see here on the West Coast? Like, is this the vehicle to do it?
Yeah, you know, Tom, I guess I'd ask you, do you have any, as you sit here today, do you have any thoughts about that issue? How do cities address this?
Yeah, I mean, if I had the answer, I might be governor. I'm not sure I have the answer. And I think that's what we all struggle with, is balancing the human need, the human interest versus safety and security of public spaces. And I think, you know, it's unfortunately, there's not a good answer. It's a nuanced question. But I do think that park bans probably aren't going to be the way that we resolve this nationwide issue. I mean, I really don't.
Yeah. You know, the sort of the critical component of this case is the fact that at the time of this law, and I don't know if this is the case today, but Grants Pass didn't have any homeless beds.
Right.
You know, beds designated for people who are otherwise unhoused to sleep in. And so the obvious answer is, well, have right. a place for them to go, right? Yeah. If you want to kick them out of the park, they need to have a place to go. I want to say Justice Alito kind of asks about this during the oral arguments, like, how do you know how many beds to have? Right. And, you know, I think the obvious problem that's being raised is this is a variable and there's no way to predict, you know, do we have a police force that's capable of going out at 7 o'clock and counting the unhoused people and perhaps even asking them, you know, oh, do you have somewhere to go tonight? Do you have somewhere to sleep tonight? Which I think that's raised by Justice Alito as sort of a...
what are they supposed to do?
Yeah, that's right. You know, an obviously not plausible solution.
Which brings in that Eighth Amendment argument of the cruel and unusual, right? It's like, if there's no other place to go, it seems rather cruel and unusual to say you cannot sleep here. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
My question to you, Everett, would be, do you think they're going to decide it on the actual merits of the case? Or are we going to find them finding a way to get out of this because, or it's an easy answer, like, hey, there were no beds, so this doesn't fly.
It's interesting. So the U.S. Attorney, the U.S. Solicitor General, different than the Attorney General, actually filed an amicus brief right. in this case. And the position of the Solicitor General is not that the rule in and of itself or that the class designation, either one of them are wrong. The issue is with the way a class was formed,
right.
because it eliminates the focus on the individuals. It's saying there exists this group of people that are unhoused. And Solicitor General says that's not really true.
Which is kind of emblematic of the problem, of the challenge, because there are folks that just lost their job last week. And so, you know, this month they can't pay rent and they're houseless. But there's other folks that have mental issues and that's why they're, you know, on the street or unable to find housing. So I think it's interesting that she took that stance. And I think it, like I said, it's emblematic of the problem. It's a nuanced problem and it can be an individual by individual problem or challenge, right, to be addressed. So,
I think her position ultimately is that notwithstanding the characterization, the classification of this group of people, that the rule probably has some problems.
Yeah.
But that I think that the take is her take or her position is those problems could be cured by a case by case determination,
right.
which of course opens a whole bunch of other questions,
right?
Like who's getting the benefit of that analysis? How do you make that analysis and who gets the benefit of it?
Right.
You know, you brought up a couple of examples, right? So a perhaps chronic drug user or a serious mental health sufferer, or you know, someone who's lost their job and just got evicted and it's the first time they've been homeless at the age of 40, who gets the benefit? How do we triage that? I mean, I don't, of course, I have no clue.
Again, you'd be governor if you did. You figured it all out. Oh, Everett, you mentioned that this is our first of this series of podcasts. So series one, episode one, which is very exciting, but we're going to work on our transitions.
Maybe we need like, you know, we've got this soundboard. Maybe we could get like one of those music. Batman transitions. Like,
with some spinning effects too.
Yeah, we'll get the hang of this, you guys.
As we said at the outset, that we do have three matters we're talking about today. The third one is Oregon House Bill 4121. That was just signed by the governor in March. And it relates to, as I said at the top, cannabis and the hemp industry. By way of a very brief background, for those who aren't already familiar with it, the cannabis industry is in a strange place in the United States, right? So there's different rules and laws state by state. And in most states now, in the union, most states have some level of legal cannabis use, whether it's medical or adult use. The industry is getting away from saying recreational, so it's medical or adult use. So various states have various legal schemes that allow this.
Yes. Interesting. This is the first time I've heard this. I've not heard that delineation. What's the policy behind that?
Yeah, so I think the idea is to look at it less as a recreational thing to use and to just say, look, this is an adult use. So is it just all for fun and shits and giggles? Or is it, it's for adults to use if and how and when they like versus medical, right? So you might have someone with a medical need, but they're just going to be using the recreational market. They don't want to get the medical card, whatever the case might be. They're adults, they're doing adult use, whether or not it's recreational or not. So
there's some sort of, someone's taken offense the idea that they were being recreational.
That's right. They're just being adults.
Okay. Maybe that's not funny. We should allow it. I mean, it makes me chuckle a tiny bit.
A little bit.
Okay.
So I think that's good background to have. And of course, you contrast that to the fact that in the U.S., it's still, you know, DEA Schedule 1 illegal. So we have our various states. We have the federal level where it's, you know, completely illegal. And that creates a lot of complications for people in the industry, for businesses in the industry, from getting banking to getting insurance to being a tenant to, frankly, doing your taxes. They have this 280E as part of the IRS code that says you may not deduct expenses if this is, you know, if you're dealing in an industry or with a product that's on a Schedule 1. So I like that background because it does help folks that don't delve in this a lot kind of understand the complicated nature of cannabis in the U.S.
Yeah, it's super complicated.
It's super complicated. Yeah. I mean, we could probably do about 10 episodes just on that, which could be fun someday.
We'll see. You know, I sort of have dipped my toes into this world. You're pretty experienced in these types of questions, and so you're going to lead this conversation. But there'll be times as we talk, I think I'm going to ask you stupid questions, Tom, because people come in and they say, what
can I do?
What can I do? And I'm like, you know what? Call Tom.
Yeah, thank you. And so the last bit about that complicated landscape is that you contrast cannabis plants to hemp plants. So these are just two varieties of the same species, and they're classified in the 2018 Farm Bill. We get the notion of industrial hemp, which is from a cannabis plant that has less than 0.3% by dry weight of this THC chemical in it. So cannabis plants have lots of cannabinoids in them. And the two most prevalent or the most well-known as well are THC and CBD. So in a industrial hemp plant, you have less than 0.3% dry weight of THC. And if that's the plant that you're starting with, then folks argue you're exempt, you're clear under the 2018 Farm Bill. There's some complications in there too as to is it ingestible or topical and so forth. But you've got to understand that there's the complication of states versus federal. And this is important. I'm getting to it, I promise. And the complication of the cannabis plants being, you know, industrial hemp, which is the 0.3% or less, versus cannabis plant. And then you have this notion of the fact that there's actually like 100 plus cannabinoids in the cannabis plant. And recently, over the last couple of years, many in the industry have realized that we can start with a hemp plant, and we can pull a heck of a lot out of it, and we can even pull THC, enough THC out of an industrial hemp plant to have what is called hemp-derived THC.
that's important to know because there's a bit of a loop. I don't know if I call it a loophole or just when the Farm Bill came out, there wasn't an understanding that we could get to these psychoactive cannabinoids using the plant that otherwise is legal under the Farm Bill.
So the important point of clarification is that measuring component, to the extent anybody's enforcing any sort of regulations regarding that, in theory, that would happen at the plant stage,
right?
That 0.3% applies to what is in this plant at the time it's mature.
That's right.
And if you know, Tom, and maybe you don't, I certainly don't, how much THC is there in a modern THC
in a plant? Well, obviously, it'd be over 0.3% for purposes of classification, but I think the cannabis plants, I believe it's 10 to 15% dry weight.
Okay.
I'm sure, you know.
So we're talking about a pretty significant limitation when you're looking at the dry weight the plants.
Yes, it's minimal. I mean, 0.3%, less than 0.3%. And oftentimes, you know, they'll measure THC by dry weight. That's a non-measurable percent. It's so low, right? So your industrial hemp plant has actually essentially 0% THC.
So if you were to take that plant and either ingest it or smoke it the way you would smoke a THC bearing cannabis plant, you might not get high without a lot.
You very likely would not. Yeah, you would very likely not have any psychoactive effects. But if you're a
can I say in a podcast, get high? Is that okay?
Yeah, I think so.
If I do this,
yeah.
We're all grown ups.
But we have a lot of smart scientists in this world. We have a lot of smart agricultural people in this world, and so they've realized that they can take the starting point of the 2018 Farm Bill allowed industrial hemp plant, and they can basically distill it, for lack of a better term, and get an enough of the THC or other cannabinoids, which we haven't discussed, that do have a psychoactive effect, so that essentially they're making stuff that gets you high from a plant that arguably is not covered, or not arguably, is exempt under the Farm Bill.
And you can imagine, and perhaps this is actually happening, you can imagine a world in which you've got very, like you said, very smart, biologically educated, chemically educated, or, you know, educated in biology or chemistry, folks that are attempting to get to like that absolute maximum number.
That's right.
In by way of hybridization of plants.
And the other thing too that's important is both plants, the cannabis and the industrial hemp plants, have a bunch of other cannabinoids in there. And research and scientists have figured out, you know, they can distill out these particular cannabinoids to great effect, whether it's CBN, CBD, CBG. So there's all these things that they can pull out. And what I was getting to a minute ago, THC, they can actually get enough THC out of the industrial hemp plants to get you high, basically. So there's this notion of hemp-derived THC.
Oh, okay, so I've got one more question.
Yeah.
With regards to, so that prior question, we're talking about the dry plant. There's currently no prohibition in taking the THC derived from these 0.3% hemp plants and delivering that in an ultra concentrated form, right?
You are asking a perfect segue question. So that's the idea. So a lot of states now have realized, oh no, there's this giant loophole. Again, I don't know that it's a loophole. There's a statutory issue with it. So basically, as the states roll this out, they did not consider the fact that you can get psychoactive psychoactive cannabinoids at such a concentration to actually have it work. So, and that's all important for a number of reasons here, including for House Bill 4121, because many states now, California, I believe, just to our south, have started to address this. They say, well, what are we going to be able to do so that people aren't kind of doing this end around? So in Oregon, one of the initial steps in addressing this is House Bill 4121. I should point out also one of these other fun facts and features. The cannabis, the OLCC, the Oregon Liquor and Cannabis Commission, they are in charge of regulating cannabis, right? Cannabis plants that turn into cannabis. On the other side, the industrial hemp is regulated by Oregon Department of Agriculture, the ODA. And not that those two agencies don't talk, but they have different responsibilities, different purviews, different rules and regs that they're following. So, you know, if you're a person working on the hemp side, now, I shouldn't say now, person working on the hemp side, it's just ODA. You're just, you know, under the purview of the ODA. So what among the things 4121 has done, and now I guess we can get into talking a little bit more about what House Bill 4121 is and does. Importantly, it's trying, one of the things it's trying to do is sort of link up the ODA and the OLCC to kind of team up.
Get these folks to work together.
Kind of get these folks to work together. That's right. So I should back up just a minute and say, you know, my understanding from folks in the cannabis industry is that 4121 was a good thing. It's a positive thing. We'll get to one of the major features of it in a moment regarding number of licenses in the state of Oregon. But, you know, my understanding is that having some consistency. So if you're operating in industry A, now industry B can come encroach on your industry because they're not regulated the same way you are. That creates some issues, right?
Yeah.
So my understanding is 4121 is actually, I wouldn't say celebrated. No one celebrates rules and regs that much, but it was it's pro cannabis industry.
Yeah, well, and that's actually when you first told me about this, and I started Googling it to sort of, well, what is this thing? I think you'd be forgiven for reading about HB 4121 and understanding it to be really a House bill aimed at addressing the overproduction in the cannabis world. So we're capping the amount of licenses formally. We've had this temporary licensure cap or licensure moratorium, which is set to sunset. I think last month it was set to sunset.
Yeah.
And so this is just finalizing that moratorium. And I think most of the things that I've read about this say, Oregon approves bill formalizing the cap in place of the moratorium set to sunset.
Well, and that is a major feature of the bill. And one of the things that folks in the cannabis industry are actually happy about, because, you know, you don't want a McDonald's on every single corner.
Yeah.
And this helps keep the number of McDonald's restaurants down.
Tom, was it you telling me or somebody else telling me that the amount of dispensaries in Oregon are more than the amount of McDonald's, Starbucks, and something else combined?
That wasn't me, but I believe it. There are there's 3,000 plus licensees in the state of Oregon, and many of them are retail.
We oftentimes talk about Starbucks being so ubiquitous that, you know, you'll have them catty corner to one another or whatever in the U.S. But it's important to note, right now, marijuana dispensaries, cannabis dispensaries in the state of Oregon outpace the amount of McDonald's, Starbucks, and something else combined.
Oh, that's crazy.
Combined, we have so many places that you can.
And
get
so
high.
One of the things you were mentioning, so we sort of started this bit talking about, you know, the difference of hemp versus cannabis and sort of the end around that some folks have perceived the folks working in the hemp side to be taking. But you brought it up. Let's dive into it. One of the major features is this moratorium. So there's been a moratorium in place. There's since, I believe, 2018, there's been a couple different attempts at limiting license count and so forth. But it seems like we finally are to a place where we've decided, hey, we're going to cap this. And it looks to be taking on a similar approach as on the alcohol side. So the OLCC, Oregon Liquor and Cannabis Commission, regulates both alcohol in the state of Oregon and cannabis, just for extra confusion, right? Just to mix one more piece into the pot.
Yeah. I do like that they didn't have to change their name. They were like, well, control is kind of an extra word. Nobody needs it anyway.
That's pretty funny. So there's some really distinct features. So on the alcohol side, you can't, it's called a tied house laws, and it prohibits certain licenses from owning or having a part of other licenses. So on the alcohol side, you have a producer, you have a wholesaler or distributor, right? The middle person that takes the beer produced or the alcohol produced and takes it to the retail stores. Then you have retail stores. So three tiers. And the same's mostly true on the cannabis side. You have producers, the farms. You have processors that take the flowers and do whatever they need to do with it. You also have wholesalers, the middleman, if you will. Important, you know, key part of the chain. And then retail establishments. On the alcohol side, there are rules prohibiting this multi-tier or vertically integrated ownership. Not so much on the cannabis side.
You can do all of it.
You can do all of it, yeah. One owner can, again, they call it vertically integrated. You own the whole chain.
You're doing your own producing, own refinement, your own laboratory testing, and even perhaps selling it.
Yeah, that's right.
In a retail fashion.
And it's helpful for keeping the margin, but it's still, it's a complicated business, right? It's complicated to run all those tiers.
And it requires multiple levels of licensure.
That's right. That's right. The other, another big distinction is on the alcohol side, right? It's the state of Oregon that owns the alcohol and the retail stores sell it. Not so much on the cannabis side. Again, you're the farm, you created it, you own it. You know, the booze that's at the retail establishments owned by the state versus on the cannabis side. So two distinct things there. And I mentioned that because when the cannabis rules and regs were rolled out, you know, they took some notes from the alcohol side, but not a lot for those differences I just mentioned. But finally, it's seeming like they're going to take a page out of the book for licenses, and they're going to do it per population. So the moratorium, it was supposed to expire on the 31st of March. HB 4121 pushed that out to December 31. And then at that time, they're going to switch to this license number of licensees per population.
I think it's variable among the different types of licenses.
Yeah.
You need fewer laboratory licenses, testing laboratory licenses, than you do retailers.
Well, and those ones actually aren't subject to a cap. So the four licenses I mentioned, so they're going to have one per 7,500 people for retail and production, and then one per 12,500 for processors and wholesaler licenses.
And when we say people, we're talking about people over the age
That's
of 21,
right,
correct?
That's right. Exactly. Importantly, so there will be a cap, and we are so far over the cap that they've contemplated, those numbers I just mentioned, that in the foreseeable future, we will have no new licenses. So the moratorium is essentially extended for a very, very, very long time via this new vehicle of limiting per population.
And what about prohibitions on transferring? You know, one of the things that folks have been able to do for a long time is transfer the license.
Yeah, buy and sell licenses.
Which is something, as I understand the moratorium, the temporary, this moratorium that's just sunsetted, that didn't limit the ability to transfer. How is that different now?
That's a good question. No. So that if you've got a license, when you renew it, that doesn't count as a new license. If you were to buy or sell it, that doesn't count as a new license. It might affect the mechanisms for how those happen downstream, but as far as numbers, as far as count of licenses, that will not be affected by a buy or sell or when you renew your license. Makes sense.
So arguably, I mean, we've got a burgeoning industry here in more ways than one. Arguably, those licenses are going to, especially the longer this moratorium or this cap affects the ability of the state to issue new licenses, those licenses are going to become more and more valuable.
That's
as
right.
you know, because not all of them are going to get transferred.
Right.
Some of them are going to terminate as just a matter of, you know, circumstance.
Sure.
But as those things start to dry up, right now I assume it's probably pretty easy to buy a license, but 5 years from now, 10 years from now, who knows? These things could become really valuable.
Well, and it also follows, I think you might've mentioned at the top of this subject, but among the many fun and complicated things about the industry, there has been boom and bust cycles already. And we've had some pretty major booms and some pretty challenging busts. And, you know, when we're in the lowest point, those licenses are a lot cheaper, right? So it's going to be interesting. I think, you know, I don't believe the population of the state is estimated to be going up so much that we'll even get above those caps for a very long time. So it's kind of, we have a finite set, I think, at this point of licenses.
Yeah, you know, Tom, when I was in high school, I heard from people around me, certainly I had no direct knowledge, but I heard that an ounce of marijuana was something like $250. Driving to work, there are at least two billboards that I drive by that advertise $20 ounces, which is a huge delta. And of course, we're talking about an age where, you know, I don't want to say when I was in high school, but it was a long time ago.
Yeah.
And it was before the state had legalized recreational marijuana or adult cannabis use.
Right.
It's not surprising that the prices would have changed from then. But even going back, I want to say in 2017, we had a per pound price of wholesale cannabis of roughly $1,800. Mm-hmm. We're down in as of March 23rd, it was the latest figure I could find, a per pound price of $600. So that's a 33% or a 66% reduction. So those prices, even in the context of legalized adult cannabis, is tremendous.
That's right.
It's got to be. I have to imagine at some point it becomes hard for these license holders to make money.
It really, yeah. I mean, you've lighted on something very important and something, you know, the industry struggles with is. It is. It's hard. It's a slog. And like with most industries, you know, if you're a mom and pop shop, you know, it's harder to make it. If you're a smaller farm, it's harder to make it. So I think it makes sense to limit, right? We don't need more licensees. We don't need more folks, you know, entering the pool and just making it harder for the folks that are already there.
You know, Oregon is, if this is too much of an aside, Tom, yeah. Oregon is sort of famously pro small business mom and pop with regards to the booze industry. So mm-hmm. both liquor and beer, right? Oregon has often been referred to as sort of the home of microbrews in some ways, one of the homes of microbrews. And we're famous for having a lot of good, you know, especially in the 80s, 90s. A lot of that has to do with the way Oregon regulates the sale. You know, you've talked about that non-vertical integration. Do we see similar attributes of that, like pro small business here in the cannabis industry, or is that vertical integration component make that not quite the same?
I think the vertical integration actually opens up opportunities, right? So you can capture margin at more levels. But it takes capital to get the license. It takes capital to set up, you know, that next tier, the next, you know, license tier up.
I guess the question is, does that make it easier for big businesses to squish the smaller businesses?
Good question. Probably. I mean, it is. It's, you know, economies of scale. If you're able to capture margin at multiple levels, if you're able to have multiple retail accounts, right, then your overhead is not that much different from one store to 10 stores.
Yeah.
To your comment about the craft beer boom and industry, I think number one, it's the water. Right? Yeah. it's the quality of water.
We've got a lot of it and it's, got a and lot it's of pretty it. Good.
It's really good water. That's well known. Secondly, and I, you know, this goes back to the 2000s, but, and maybe even before actually. One of the nice things that I mentioned the Tide House Law, and you can't have ownership in multiple tiers, but you can have in certain production licenses, certain brewer licenses, you're allowed to distribute up to a certain amount yourself. So whereas you can't own a distributorship and a brewery, for example. But if you're a brewery, you can self-distribute up to a certain amount, which made it good for small startups, small breweries to make their product and get it out there. The same, you know, the same isn't necessarily true on the cannabis side, except that you can buy the wholesaler license too. So, you know, you can get vertically integrated, but you don't have that production license that allows you to do more things as well.
Yeah. So this has obviously been sort of sold to the producers and the industry as something that's going to be really helpful. I think so. we've been really clear about the fact that this is going to, at least over time, limit the amount of people producing and selling, which will help those folks already doing that recover those margins. It does seem to me like there's also some pork here, or perhaps some tag-alongs with regards to limiting the ability of companies to use hemp. And so maybe there's a little bit of compromise there.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, I actually think that it does. It's also pro-cannabis side if you're starting to more heavily regulate, monitor, deal with the industrial hemp side. And that is, you know, circling back to, I think, the first bit we got into on this, talking about the ODA and the OLCC being basically forced to work together as far as their inspections go. And they're now specifically allowed to take law enforcement with them. And if it's a super egregious or scary situation, they're allowed to take the governor can send in the National Guard to help folks as they're doing their inspections.
Pretty yeah. Cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you can get a lot of, you know, basically some more muscles, some more power behind literally going out and doing these inspections. Another interesting bit is that there's going to be a map, a producer map for cannabis, and that will and industrial hemp, and so that'll help fight off the black market as well. So, you know, if we
identify illegal grow sites, right. You're not on my map, so right. This isn't legal.
That's right.
Yeah,
we'll go call the National Guard, and we'll go come in and take a look at it.
Yeah, that, I thought that was the most interesting part of this was the ability of the governor to call the National Guard. Right? I mean, that's that, you know, famously Posse Comitatus Act limits the ability of the military, the United States military, to do law enforcement activities, but that doesn't apply to the National Guard. Right. So the state said, hey, we're specifically authorizing the governor to use the National Guard.
Which, again, instance. I think is pro-cannabis industry to have that weight to force out the black market. So it's going to continue to support the folks operating legally.
Well, Tom, we're here. We've done the thing. We're just about out of time today. This has been really fun.
Really fun. Yeah.
We're going to do this every month, or at least that's the plan at this point. So we want to thank you folks who have tuned in. Anything you want to add before we go?
Everett, because this is our first one, I'm just going to ask you directly, how do we fix our mistakes? We go back and listen to this and we go, wait, that number was wrong. That date was wrong. Can we put those in the notes as well?
We can. Okay. And you know what? If we said anything today that you don't like or you disagreed with, you can email us at info@OregonReporterPodcast.com.
That would be great.
Tell us all about it.
Get a conversation going. Absolutely.
And then perhaps next month we'll talk about those things.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, I just want to thank everybody for joining us for this inaugural season one, episode one of the Oregon Reporter Podcast. Again, this episode will qualify you for one general MCLE credit upon your self-reporting on your MCLE transcript. The MCLE ID number for today's episode is 111146. Please refer to the show notes or OregonReporterPodcast.com for reporting instructions. And I want you to look for episode two, which will be coming in June.
Thanks, everyone. Bye.